And there's so many different ways you can skin the cat. And there's something that solved the problem with the transistor. Did it by using the larger capacitance. So that, just like you said, it swamps it out. Beautiful, beautiful technique. And it's used a lot. All right, let me let her drop. Go on to the next one.
VDH with a quick question.
VDH, go right ahead.
Oh, yeah, fine business. Thanks, Dick. Yeah, I just had a question. When you define the Q of an antenna, the formula of energy stored over energy dissipated per cycle, can you view that as energy stored over energy radiated per cycle? Go ahead.
Absolutely. Energy stored versus energy dissipated. Now, as far as the resonant circuit is concerned, it's really like a child on a swing. A child on a swing is a fairly high Q circuit. The child is swinging back and forth, and as long as you push the child in a co-phase manner, you can build up a nice great big amount of stored energy. So the movement of the child on the swing is the stored energy. The dissipation is the friction in the bearing at the top of the swing, if you know what I mean. In the case of a resonator, every antenna that you and I build, with rare exception, is a resonator. In other words, it's got a standing wave structure. It's got the energy bouncing back and forth before it gets radiated. And the rate at which you lose that energy is really what Q is telling you. And you're losing the energy either because you've got some resistive components in the antenna and the energy is being wasted by being turned into heat, or you've done a good job of making the radiator exposed to free space and it's radiating the signal out into space. In either case, there's an equivalent radiation resistance. We put a resistor in the schematic diagram of the antenna. Let me drop. We put a resistor in the diagram. We call it radiation resistance. In other words, if it was a sealed structure that was shielded so it couldn't radiate, and you put in that value of resistor, it'd have the exact same Q as when the real antenna, without that resistor, is doing its radiating. So radiation resistance. So there's two ways you lose energy in that resonator that you and I call antenna. Real resistor, I squared R loss, and signal being sent into space. As far as the resonator is concerned, he doesn't care. The rate at which he's losing that energy per cycle determines the Q when you compare it to the amount of energy he's storing per cycle. So I think you've got it right there, sir. Mr. VDH, KQRIW.
Oh, fine business, Dick. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it just gives me something more to think about. I never considered actually antennas from a transient point of view. Thanks very much, Dick. I'll let you go on to the next question.
But along those lines, one of the things that's kind of hard to believe is that every antenna has a finite rise time to it. If you study what your simple dipole or your Yagi is doing, doesn't matter, you realize that there's a lot of energy bouncing back and forth 10 times or so before it finally gets radiated in space. It's really a kind of a flywheel. You can't instantaneously go from zero RPM up to full RPM of a flywheel. It takes you some time. By the same token, if you put a very fast-acting oscilloscope looking at what's going on inside of an antenna, you realize that it might take 10 or 20 cycles of your transmitter before the antenna comes up to full power at the antenna. By the same token, if you've got a very fast-acting switch and you abruptly turn off the transmitter power going to the antenna has a ring down time. It's like a bell. So on a good scope, you can watch the antenna ring down, or in other words, the antenna really has a rise time and a full time. If you were transmitting extremely fast pulses, let me drop. If you're transmitting extremely fast pulses, the rise time and the full time of the antenna's response to your transmitter could be a limiting factor. There are antennas that have got very high Q, and therefore it takes you some number of nanoseconds to bring the antenna up to full speed. I saw this very dramatically in that experiment I was doing at the Edwards Air Force Base, the Benningfield Anechoic Facility. In order to do the testing I was doing there, I was generating pulses at 10 gigahertz, 10,000 megahertz. 10 gigahertz pulses. The pulses I was generating were a quarter of a nanosecond long each. Each pulse was approximately 3 cycles of 10 gigahertz. generating a million of those pulses per second. So when you're transmitting pulses that fast, how fast is the rise time of the traveling wave tube that's amplifying the pulses? How fast is the rise time and the bandwidth of the antenna that's transmitting those pulses? Thank goodness I was using antennas that were an octave wide. The antenna itself covered 10 gigahertz to 18 gigahertz inclusive. That's where it had rated performance, and it worked wider bandwidth than that. So the antenna could tolerate those fast rising pulses. The traveling wave tube, if I carefully chose the right serial number, because they're all a little bit different, it could tolerate those fast pulses. And when you do that, a quarter of a nanosecond pulse at 10 gig, what's the value of that? That's the world's highest resolution radar you've ever heard of. That radar, when I aimed it into that chamber, had a range resolution of approximately a quarter of a foot. I could look at this 300-foot wide chamber. I could look at that chamber a quarter of a foot at a time and find every nail and adapter that had been dropped into that anechoic chamber, into that anechoic material. I had a quarter of a foot of nano, a quarter of a foot of range resolution as a radar.
Repeater, timeout.
Ain't that crazy? Mr. VDH, I bet you've never heard that one before. K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, fine business, Dick. Yeah, this is very interesting. I have access to some equipment over at my school. I think I may try a couple of experiments just to see what's what. But again, thanks very much for the information, Dick.
Hey, you've signed in a few times before. I don't know the prefix of your call and your name, sir. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick. Yeah, the complete call is WA2VDH, and the handle is John.
Very fine, John. Yeah, I think there was a time when you checked in and I called you John number two. So, Roosevelt, New York. Is that on Long Island, John?
I'm about 2 miles from Hofstra, not far from the Freeport border. By exit 21 on Southern State. Go ahead.
Okay, it'd be nice to find out that in that town that would allow you to put up a tower. Because we VHF people, unless you live on top of an apartment building, we need towers. Okay, maybe it's time to go on to the next one, John. If you're on the one, KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Dick, you think we have enough time, or you want to go over to Paul? What do you care to do?
Let's go to Paul. And Paul, what has NASA been doing? WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, there we go. Very good. And John, I don't have all that much. Maybe we could go back to you later. But good evening, everybody. This is WS2N space portion of the TechNet. I wanted to mention one company, Sierra Nevada, who lost the bid by NASA to get their spacecraft. What they're developing is the Dream Chaser. I've talked about that many times on the net, and that's the one that's one-sixth of the size of the shell. You can put about seven astronauts on board. Looks like a shell would be able to land on any runway. You don't need a 3-mile runway. But they lost the bid to SpaceX and Boeing. They got the Boeing got like over $4.5 billion, and SpaceX got close to $3 billion, and Sierra Nevada got nothing, as well as Blue Origin. That's another company that was in the running, but not quite. But this company thought that they had a shot, and then they were talking recently about if they lose that. They'll talk to Japan about getting a launch ship, from Japan, actually put it on a Japanese rocket. I heard that's a possibility, but now they actually signed a contract with a company I've probably only talked about a couple of times on the net, because they're a couple of years away from developing what they want to develop. The craft that they're building is called the Strata Launch. Now, the Strata Launch is it's a carrier. The idea is to take a rocket up to a certain height, and then let the rocket drop and then go into space. Similar to what Virgin Galactic is doing, or has done with their White Knight. They'll bring up their spacecraft. They used it for a couple of flights. White Knight used it for Spaceship One, which is the one that won the Antari Prize 10 years ago. By putting one astronaut into space and then within a two-week period doing it again. It was suborbital, and now they're building their spacecraft. Hopefully next year they'll be taking up passengers on Spaceship 2, and that gets launched by the White Knight. Gets carried up on its carrier, the White Knight drops it up and lights its rocket and goes into suborbital space. Well, this other one, Strata Launch, is similar to White Knight, except it's much bigger, a lot bigger. The craft itself, takeoff would weigh over 1 million pounds. Yeah. If you took two 747s and attached the wings, you know, two of the wings together, so now you have two fuselages to take off and land and put a launch.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And then another 300, put it on the far left wing. So this company, Strata Launch, has now made a deal with Sierra Nevada to launch their Dream Chaser spacecraft. They're going to cut back on the size. Instead of carrying seven astronauts, they're going to carry three. So I thought I'd bring that up. NASA, you know, they only have so much money to go around, and then they pour the money into Boeing and to SpaceX. But these people, you know, they've been in the space industry probably for 30 years or more. Nobody's going to chase them away. So you might see a test launch of the Strata launch vehicle, which is halfway built, probably within 2 years out in California. They've already built the hangar for it and everything. To give you an idea of the size, the wingspan of this thing will be bigger than anything that's ever flown. You know? So that should be pretty cool. I want to bring up the comet sighting spring that's heading to Mars, and that'll be in October 19th coming up. The closest approach would be some 80,000 miles to the planet. So it's not going to hit, but they worry about the debris that might be coming off the tail. And from what I read, that they're expecting less and less of it now. But amount of telescopes that are going to be looking at this thing from the ground on Mars, you have Curiosity and Opportunity. They'll be able to see it from the orbital position in Mars. You'll have Mars Odyssey. Drop it. You'll have MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Possibly Mars Express by the European Space Agency. That's also in orbit around the planet. And another one that would be able to look at it is the new one that just got up there, MAVEN. I don't know if India is going to participate with their MOM spacecraft that just went into orbit last month as well. But MAVEN will get involved. No question about that, they said. You have other telescopes that are going to look at this. It's very rare to have a comet come close to Mars. like once-in-a-lifetime things that are going to point everything toward this, including the Hubble, the Swift, the WISE, the, even the stereo telescopes. They're the ones that are the spacecraft that are in orbit around the sun in the same distance from the sun as Earth. It's really in the Earth orbit path around the sun. But these two things are going to be looking at it. I don't know what they're going to see so far away, but I guess they're going to examine it, examine the comet and all the different possible wavelengths. Because even Chandra is going to look at it. And that's the one that looks at X-rays and all. So I'm not sure what they're going to be doing. But everything, including some of the telescopes on Earth, in Hawaii and all. Let me drop it. And I just wanted to bring up one other telescope that they just broke ground on. I think we've talked about it a little bit on the net before. I think you've talked about it more than I have, Dick. The TMT, the 30-meter telescope that has been funded, and now they broke ground in Hawaii. And this is one of these telescopes that are going to be almost 100 feet in diameter. And you compare that to anything on Earth, and it's, right now it would be the biggest one. You know, once it gets built, it's going to have almost 500 segments of traffic. They don't build the big telescopes out of one mirror anymore. They've been segmented because they're too big. You can't make a mirror that big. So ever since Keck went online back in the early 90s, Keck telescope in Hawaii, that was built out of 36 segmented mirrors, and that was very successful. And then actually there's a Keck 2 that came online a few years after that, also with 36 mirrors, also in Hawaii. They know the technology works. They have to keep it, each mirror aligned like within 1/1,000,000th of a meter or something to get a good picture. So instead of 36, they're going to have, I think it's 496, almost 500 segmented mirrors to build this thing, 100 feet across. So that should be pretty cool. I read the story from Ed Stone. He's a Voyager fame. He was the one that was on and still involved with Voyager from the very beginning until now. Actually, he's no kid anymore, but now he's involved with this telescope. With the 492 hexagonal mirrors that they're going to start putting together. And it should come online, they said, in early 2020. I think I read 2022. It's probably the earliest time that thing should come online. And power-wise, well, according to what I've read, it's supposed to be 10 times more powerful. But according to Ed Stone, he was doing the math, and it was coming out to 81 times more powerful because of a couple of reasons. One was the adaptive optics. They shoot a laser into the sky, a regular beam. They create an artificial star based on that. They could get rid of the twinkling, and he said that would make it 9 times more powerful. And then, based on the size, this 100-foot diameter thing compared to Keck, whatever it is, I think it's 30 or something, or 10 meters. You know, he did the math on that, and he came out with, that was also 9, so he multiplied 9 times 9, and he got himself 81. So, nevertheless, it'll be naturally more powerful than anything we got, even, you know, much more powerful than the Hubble Space Telescope. I thought that was pretty interesting. We drop it. Atari rocket that'll be launching the fourth Cygnus cargo freighter up to the International Space Station, and that will be happening in October as well, a couple weeks from now, October 24th. So that's interesting because that'll be the last of their regular flights of the Cygnus, and after that they go to the enhanced version, so they'll probably be able to bring up 12, 13, 14, 100 pounds more cargo than they do now, you know, 10, 20% more, because they're going to have a bigger engine, different solar panels built by ATK. By the way, ATK is now partnered with actually one company, Orbital and ATK. ATK is a gigantic, massive, colossal company that's been around forever. And they got plenty of money. And with Orbital, what they plan on doing, those two companies are going to be formidable. I think they're going to give SpaceX a run for their money in the future. Back to you, Dick. That's pretty much it. Let me drop it. The space portion of the net. Anybody has any questions, they can do that. And, of course, they could always get a hold of me on spacenetreport.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. Any questions, Dick, or anything, any comments? K2RIW, this is WS2N.
Yeah, that 30-meter telescope, roughly 100 feet in diameter, I call that overwhelmingly large. I think telescopes in the past have been given names like that. And to get with 36 individual hexagonal segments all put together in a great big frame where you can tune each one of them in position and tilt angle to get them to act like one great big mirror is a very effective way of doing things. So now this 30-meter telescope, where they just broke ground, 500 segments, and you said that they've all got to be accurate to the nearest micrometer. Better than that, Paul. The usual definition of diffraction-limited telescope. Let me drop. As you make the mirror and mirror more accurate, less and less bumps, and more accurate to the shape, you eventually approach something they call diffraction-limited. That means making the mirror any better doesn't give you any improvement. And one of the definitions of diffraction-limited is everything on the mirror has a 20th of a wavelength of accuracy. So if you're talking about the middle of the optical band, 550 nanometers is the wavelength of the light that's yellow-green in the middle of the optical band, and you go to a 20th of a wavelength of 550 nanometers, and you work out all the mathematics, you're asking for an accuracy of not a millionth of a meter, it's a millionth of an inch, one micro-inch, is the accuracy required of a mirror to be diffraction limited. So my guess is they're seeking all of those mirrors accurate and accurately positioned to the nearest millionth of an inch, micro inch. That's a good trick. But when you've got individual segments, let me drop. You've broken up the mirror into individual chunks of, I guess they're about a meter in diameter each, hexagonal. And, you've got individual actuators on the corners of that mirror that brings it down to the frame. And in the case of the 300-foot diameter radio telescope at Green Bank, West Virginia, what they've got is a laser ranging system at the focal point. It aims a laser at each one of the individual segments and determines whether or not they're in the right position by laser ranging, and therefore the computer system tells each individual actuator move out or in or tilt or whatever, so that as a function of temperature expansion, tilting the telescope in another direction, so gravity acts in a different way, wind and snow and whatever, they can correct for all of those things. That's the only way you can do it. You build a mirror, a single chunk of glass, 300 meters in diameter, 30 meters, 30 meters in diameter. The chunk of glass would be so heavy that just the weight of the glass will sag in such a way that you'll be way out of the accuracy requirement. If you don't have individual segments with individual ways of tuning those segments, you combine that with optical correction techniques. Let me drop. The active mirror approach, in other words, because the air out in front of you is shimmering, you know, when the sun shines through the water in your pool, and you look at the reflections of the water at the bottom of the pool, you look at those shadows drifting around, that's what the atmosphere is doing. The atmosphere is moving around somewhat like the water in your pool, and the starlight is shining down on that atmosphere, very similar to the sun shining down on the water in your pool. So, by way of adaptive optics, you can take the individual segments of the, I think they always do it with a secondary mirror, a deformable secondary mirror with a whole bunch of actuators, and they move them in millisecond periods of time. And so you've got a way of figuring out, by way of the beam that you shined into space, you've got a way of finding out what the atmosphere is doing at this millisecond. You tune your deformable mirror, and so now you take out almost all of the aberration of the atmosphere. So you're pretty close to coming to what would happen if that telescope was in free space where Hubble is. The state-of-the-art of adaptive optics was nowhere near as far along as it is now when Hubble was launched in 1990. So Hubble was the right way to go. Let me drop. And recently I've been reading about the deep field photograph, the ultra deep field photograph, and the extremely deep field photograph done by Hubble. And each one of those photographs are something like 1/10 of the width of the moon is the area of space being surveyed. And one of those, the last one, the extremely deep field, they integrated the picture for 2 million seconds. I think it's something like 26 days. So you're gathering individual photons. I mean, when something is that far away, even though the sun is putting millions and millions of photons into your eye, iris, each second that you stare at the sun, when a star is 13 billion years away, 13 billion light years away, it may, in your whole Dawn telescope, you may be collecting, one photon per second, maybe one photon for 10 seconds. You gather those photons for 2 million seconds. You eventually get that particular picture of that star in your photograph, so to speak, particularly if you're using the far infrared filter. The other problem you've got is the stars that are really far away, 13 billion years away, by the Hubble constant, they're moving away so fast that the light that they emit gets heavily redshifted. So unless you're using the infrared, far infrared filter, which is one of the things that Hubble can now do, you don't even see those photons. And so that extremely deep field photograph contains something like 15,000 galaxies in that tiny little piece of space. And that tiny little piece of space represents 1/28,000th of the total sky. If you had the time, let me jump. If you had the time and the resources to aim Hubble in all of those 28 million, I think it is, directions, and do a extreme deep field picture for 2 million seconds, where you look at 15,000 galaxies per picture in this tiny little piece of space, and each galaxy on average contains 100 billion stars, if somebody tells you there's a lot of stuff out there, and a lot of distance, and a lot of time, we've gone through 5 stages of realizing how big the universe is. We used to think the Earth was everything, and there's a bunch of spheres going around the Earth, and 5 times in a row we've been humbled that our planet is not the center, the solar system is not the center, our galaxy is not the center, our galactic group is not the center. Guarantee our universe is not the center. There's a bunch of multiverses out there, and I think there's many multiverses out there as you've got galaxies that you can see in these deep field pictures. We're about to go the next umpteen orders of magnitude bigger when we realize what we call the multiverse universe really is. We're getting smaller and smaller, Paul. We're becoming less and less significant in the big picture. What do you think? WS2N, K2RAW?
I can trust. And I'm the one that came out with 1 million to a meter. Ed Stone said it the other way around. He said it your way. He said to the inch. I'm thinking meters. I'm thinking the 30 meter telescope. So I'm in meter land. So I came out with 1 million of a meter instead of the inch. I think that's what happened. Yeah. You're right about that. Before I forget, I know it's a month away, so we'll probably talk about this 10 more times before we get there. But the Rosetta spacecraft is orbiting that comet 67P, and the lander will be going down to the comet and land on November 11th, around 5 o'clock. Yeah, it's a Tuesday, so if you're home, I guess they'll probably have it. I don't think that'll make it on the regular news. It's not going to be breaking news, but I'm sure you can find it on a computer. NASA would have it. NASA's part of that mission, part of the European Space Agency Rosetta mission. So I want to mention that. Also, the telescope. I was Googling around looking for different size telescopes. And there is one being built, also going to be coming online in the early 2020s. And that's one of the ones being built in Chile. And they call that the E-ELT, or European Extremely Large Telescope. This thing is 128 feet American. 39 meters, so almost 10 meters bigger than the other one. So I don't know what they're getting involved here with, Dick, but there's a lot of money being pushed around. This is the 30 meter telescope is $1.5 billion. Still trying to figure out who's supporting this thing. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the one in Chile is most likely being done by the European Southern Observatory. ESO. You Google those words, and boy, do they have one hell of a setup there for both optical and millimeter wave. Is it millimeter wave? I think it is. Telescope. Some of it is at the Altacoma Plain, one of the driest, highest places on planet Earth. These really big telescopes are making better and better discoveries. It's a good investment. When you also look at the Large Hadron Collider, you compare it against the superconducting super collider that the United States was going to build. The superconducting super collider was significantly larger than the one in CERN, Switzerland right now, Large Hadron Collider. So had we followed through on that, we would have been the leader as opposed to Switzerland right now in basic research. It's too bad that contract got canceled. Let me drop. There was a congressman at that time that the superconductor, super collider got canceled, who decided to make a joke. He said, this is superconducting super collider. Why do we have to build that? Why do we have to study science? It's all in the Bible. He was saying that as a joke, as a very left-handed chunk of humor. depending on how you interpret the good books, science has got a few more things to offer from my point of view. Don't know the whole story yet. I've got a philosophy now as to I've developed a philosophy as to what I think energy is, dark matter and dark energy. The dark energy is the one that's pushing everything away from us at an accelerating rate. I've got a guess as to what's going on. I've modified that in the last few days, but I wouldn't subject you guys to that one right now. But we're about to be humbled again, as I see it, Paul. It's very, very difficult to detect the multiverses. But in my opinion, the dark energy, the fact that stuff out of our perimeter is accelerating away from us, where I'm convinced is being sucked into the multiverses that are beyond. That's the first hint, as I see it, of what they call dark energy, is really telling us of the multiverses that are out there. And there are people who think there can only be a couple of multiverses. I think there can be as many multiverses as there are galaxies that we observe. And we can observe something in the vicinity of 100 billion to 300 billion galaxies by way of the Hubble Deep Field pictures.
We got repeater. Time out.
From our point of view, we've definitely got our money's worth out of Hubble. Even though it started off as a $2 billion fiasco because the mirror was had a huge spherical error to it. And then we sent Story Musgrove up there to give it a set of eyeglasses. Did a beautiful job. Put his life at tremendous risk to do that. He came close to dying in that operation. He had that much faith in that project that it was worth the risk that he went through to do that huge repair operation that was supposed to be two separate shuttle launches. And he said, I can name that tune in one note, one launch. And he pulled it off. Practiced like crazy with all of his people and did one hell of a repair. What a guy. You may know that he gave a personal presentation at the Air and Space Museum, at the Cradle of Aviation Museum in Hempstead, I think it is. Or I guess that was about 5 or so years ago. It was arranged by the Astronomical Society of Long Island. I was there at that lecture. He's good. You listen to him give a talk of what he went through in space and what his life has been like. Let me drop him. He's without a doubt one of a kind. An unusual guy. So, anybody out there with any further questions on all of the above, particularly some of this big stuff that Paul's telling us about, give us a call at us right now, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
N2XN.
Go ahead, Wes.
It is interesting that you mentioned dark matter or dark energy. Because not many people realized that it was 1998 when the Hubble Space Telescope Observatory was first making its journey. And the primary question at that time was whether it might have enough of energy density to stop its expansion when we're talking about the expansion of the universe and recollapse. Or it might have so little energy density that it would never stop expanding. But the gravity was certain to slow the expansion all the time, and the time went on. So the best thing that Hubble Space Telescope was able to establish is that there is no signs of slowdown. And yeah, I could have a few comments about dark energy. I would like to hear from you eventually, or dark energy, right? And eventually, I would like to go to a Roy comment. This extraordinary gentleman is writing to us as he cannot speak, and there was in the discussion when we were talking about positron it was positron emission tomography, and I couldn't find my notes at that time because you were so much puzzled with the fact that I was able to see in my lab two gamma photons at 180 degrees from the collision of the positron and electron, or the electron. But At first, I would like to give you the microphone about dark energy.
Dick, one comment about Musgrave.
Go ahead, Paul.
I just wanted to jump in there, Wesley. 1 second. Story Musgrave, his voice, ID'd on the Lockfield 145430 machine for years. I don't know. I haven't heard it lately, but somebody knew him, and you know, he would, you know, ID the repeater, you know, over and over again. That was his voice. Back to you, Dick.
Dick, G2UPS has a question for Paul.
Okay. Let's get UPS's question. We'll put all of them in the queue all at once. Rich, K2UPS. Question number one always is, are you in Ohio, West Virginia, Illinois, Pennsylvania, or New Jersey? And are you traveling east or west? And then proceed with your question. K2UPS. K2IRW. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and good evening to the Met, K2UPS Mobile. I am eastbound in Pennsylvania on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Just went through Somerset, so that's about where I am. And the question for Paul is, and I was out of the truck for a few minutes, I missed part of his report, and my apologies if he reported on this story already, but I had heard a news story about a new type of robot that I believe NASA was investigating and sought to do research on called Swarmies. Small individual robots that could go out and do searching for things, and if they found something, they could radio in, and all the other ones would come together and help them dig up whatever it was that was found. Suppose they're about the size of small radio-controlled trucks at this point, but it's this. They're working on the software more than the hardware at this point. I was wondering if Paul had any information on those. They were referring to them as Swarmies back then.
Let's go over to Paul. We're not negating the other question. We're just taking them out of order. Paul, go right ahead, because this is really an extension of the space report. You got it, Paul.
Okay, well, I know two different types that we're investigating. One they have on board the International Space Station, and they're the Spears. Now, they stand for something. I forget what the acronym is. But they have at least two of them on board, and they float around, and they move around, and fly autonomously. They've been testing these things. They can go through the different parts of the space station, and they're going to eventually use these things. They're going to utilize them. And at some point in the future, they would be capable of sending them outside to do some type of work. I don't know if that's what they're referring to. And then there's another type that going to send up almost in these CubeSat types of arrangements, very small, hundreds of these. They're not as big as little trucks. These are little matchbook sizes, and they're going to shoot out of these small CubeSats, and they'll be able to go near comets, asteroids, and investigate them. And even if 10% of them die, they don't care. The other ones, they all work together to communicate with each other. Maybe that's what you're speaking about. I'm not sure. I've been investigated. Dick, over to you.
From the beginning description that I just heard from Rich, I think he's talking about a third object different than the two that you just mentioned, Paul. Let me pass it back to Rich. And Rich, where did you become acquainted with this? KTUPS Mobile. Eastbound to K2RIW in SECNAT.
Okay, I think this might be a third one, like Dick just said. It might have been on the amateur radio news line. I'm not 100% sure. It might have been on another news program I was listening, but it was just a few days ago. Meant for a planetary surface exploration, where each individual one would kind of be doing their own thing. They're all searching for the same thing or same things, you know, certain materials or water, whatever. And if one finds something of interest, it could then communicate with the other ones, and they would then come to where that one was and help it, you know, research it, dig and whatever. But that's the one that I had heard about. It was definitely going to be some sort of rover type thing, certainly bigger than a matchbox. And I believe they were testing them. They're working on the software right now. They don't even have the device really fully developed yet, so they were kind of put on radio-controlled trucks, like model trucks, to see how that works. But the report said that they were really working on the software at this point, back to net.
That's the type that they're developing, Dick. Can I take it?
You've got a pull.
I'm actually looking for help from the public. And they want to put them on, like, craft that go down to the surface of Mars, for instance. Next time they send another lander. What happens is, to control the attitude of the spacecraft, they use nitrogen jets, but they also use weights. There's a bunch of weights surrounding that are attached to the spacecraft, and they'll shoot off. They'll actually, you know, the computer will say, okay, I'm too far this way. It'll launch. It'll go away from the spacecraft. It fine-tunes everything. It keeps going in straight. Now, they would like to make these things little robots, landers, and they're looking for help from the public. They want to, you know, send their advice in and what they should be made of, and like little, almost like a competition. That might be what Rich is talking about. Something in the future to use to go down to an asteroid or to a planet. Instead of just throwing off dead weight, you know, have something useful coming off. Back to you, Dick.
I think I'm seeing a trend where NASA, among other scientific areas, are moving into greater and greater automation. We're talking about automobiles and trucks that can drive themselves without a human being, or with very little assistance from a human being. We're talking about drones that will automatically deliver packages. It's just a matter of time before NASA comes up with repair vehicles that go to each of our synchronous satellites and do some refueling. Because you send a synchronous satellite out there, you spend $450 million building it and launching it, and it lasts for maybe 10 years. And when it runs out of fuel, it's a beautiful piece of space junk that everything is perfect except for the darn station-keeping fuel has run out. And so you can save a big portion of that 450 megabucks if you can send a robot out there to do some refueling. So to do automation, maybe with ground control, but robots to do repair of satellites, I see a lot of action in that direction. That will be possible. And so to go to a planet and not necessarily send a geologist there, but send the geologist's assistant as a robot that looks for whatever you're interested in, reports back what he sees, maybe gets assistance of the other robots that he sent there. It's just a matter of time. It's obvious. To send automation, let me drop. To send unmanned vehicles to terrible places, like every one of the nine planets, to send unmanned vehicles that work for years on end and don't require food, oxygen, and water, and life support, huge improvement. Yes, you get the data slower, but you get it at a very small fraction of the cost in both human life and dollars, so it's the right way to go. Now, when it comes to dark energy, we've heard the word dark energy, and I've got an opinion as to where that word came from. Let me drop. For decades, there has been the question the astronomers ask, astrophysicists ask, is this universe open, closed, or neutral? If it's a closed universe, Mr. Hubble himself made the measurements showing that the greater distance there is of an object from you, the faster it is moving away from you. The whole universe is expanding. The Big Bang is the best explanation as to how it all got started, the so-called
called Hubble constant. Tells you how fast something is moving away from you versus how far it is away. And almost nothing violates the Hubble constant. You choose something that's twice as far away, you find that it's moving away from you twice as fast. That's how it got twice as far away. It started off with twice as much velocity from the Big Bang. Okay? And we know that there's a hell of a lot of gravity of all the stuff in the center of this observable universe. So it's obvious to ask the question, okay, when you throw a ball straight up in the air, the gravity eventually stops the ball from moving and it comes right back down to you. By the same token, all the stuff that's moving out there is enough gravity in the center of the universe that the stuff is eventually going to stop and come back. Will the Big Bang be followed by a big crunch? That's called the closed universe. Let me drop. If you launch all of that stuff at the instant of Big Bang with a little bit more velocity, it doesn't come back. It just goes out and slowly slows down, but never stops. That's the neutral universe. The thoroughly open universe is where the stuff is moving away from you so fast that it's never going to come back. That's the thoroughly open universe. So a bunch of experiments were proposed, and two simultaneous experiments began in the late 90s with the best measurements we've got. Is the universe open, closed, or neutral? Make the measurements. The stuff that's out there, how fast is it moving? How fast is it slowing down because of the gravity? And therefore, if there's going to be a big crunch, how many years from now is the big crunch? And one of the early estimates were 80 billion years. We still got some time. Okay, so they make the measurements. And the first set of measurements come back with all three of the answers being wrong. Not open, not closed, not neutral. The stuff out there, you want to measure how fast the stuff is slowing down. And the answer was the stuff is not slowing down, it's speeding up. The stuff out there at the perimeter of our observable universe is not slowing down due to gravity, it's speeding up away from us. Who the heck is doing that? They gave it a name, dark energy. They assumed in the beginning that that's an erroneous measurement. Something's wrong with the procedure. They were afraid to announce what they measured. So they kind of held back until the second experiment, which is doing a similar measurement, came along. The second measurement came up with the exact same answer. A different technique came up with the exact same answer. The stuff out there at the perimeter is moving away at an accelerating rate, as if somebody is pushing on it. So they finally made the announcement. They called it dark energy. And what in the world is it? You've heard me say so often, I'm positive the multiverses out there have higher density than us, and it's sucking the stuff away.
Repeater, time out.
If this Earth was hollow, and you placed a chunk of matter in the center of that hollow center of the Earth, it would sit there forever. Move it a little bit off to one side, and now it's getting closer to that gravity-bearing shell of the Earth, in my example, and it would start accelerating toward the shell. So by the same token, if the density of our universe is lower than the multiverses that are beyond our observable universe, then everything out at the shell of our multiverse is going to be sucked away. And how did that happen? I'm convinced that all the stuff that's in our observable universe was at one time all in one spot at the instant of the Big Bang. But how did it get there? It was a super, super big black hole. So all the stuff was being sucked into this really big black hole just before the Big Bang. And if everything got sucked into a big black hole forever, the whole process would stop. Everything ends up in a black hole. Obviously, that's not the right answer. It is my belief that beyond a certain size, a black hole itself becomes unstable. Otherwise, everything in the universe of universes, everything would end up in a black hole, and the whole project is over. So the black hole itself, beyond a certain size, I say, is unstable. So that black hole that preceded our Big Bang sucked up everything in the neighborhood, created a lot of sparse, empty space. It became unstable because of its size. It had 10 to the 22 or 10 to the 23 solar masses. That maybe is the number where a black hole becomes unstable. It explodes. We call it Big Bang. And so we're refilling that void that was created by that black hole previously sucking up everything. And so now the stuff out at the perimeter...
Repeater, time out.
The stuff out at the perimeter is not only filling up that void that the previous Super Bowl coal produced, but it's now being sucked into those other multiverses, which the majority of them haven't had their Big Bang yet, is a guess. But think about the size of what the real universe of universes must be. When you take that Hubble deep field picture, ultra deep field picture, and out at the perimeter, you expect it to be very little. And you see 2,600 galaxies you've never seen before out at the perimeter. And they have at least as much density as the ones nearby. We're not running out of them at the perimeter, if you know what I mean. For us to think that there's nothing beyond our observable universe, that would take a lot of arrogance. To think that everything favors us and that's all the stuff there is, and we can observe it. No way. The amount of stuff that's out there beyond us, beyond our 10 to the 23 solar masses, of our 10 to 11 observable galaxies, guaranteed there's a lot more. How in the world did all of this get started? You know what I mean by world? How in the universe of universes did all this get started? It's enough to make a person religious. Let me drop this.
Comment. On space.com, I found it.
Okay, but being religious only moves the problem back one step. If you think a deity did all this, then the next question is, well, where did the deity come from? And so a truly spiritual person will say, well, he always existed. Well, a secular person could say, the universe always existed. All the matter was always there. The mass energy product was always there. And it's just changing from one to the other, from time to time and place to place. It has no choice. What did you just say, Paul? WS2NKQIW?
Yeah, I just want to get it in before Rich goes away. I don't know, you know how long he can stay in contact. The Swamis, I found that on space.com. Small, very small robots, rovers. Probably, you know, maybe the size of maybe 3 foot by 2 foot or something like that. But, you know, I mean, they're going to pre-pour these things down to a planet at a time, and then they're going to work together. You know, if they find something, they'll let the other one know. But this is far off. They mentioned in the article this is far off. This is something that they're playing around with. Back to you, Dick.
Pick up a comment in a minute. Yeah, we're moving in that direction. When you take a look at the very first cell phone, which was called a brick, 2.5 pounds, great big thing, with a battery on board that was good for 20 minutes of talking. We've come a long way with miniaturization, with automation, with circuits that can self... each of the things crawling around on the surface of Mars right now, Spirit, Opportunity, and Curiosity, have a certain amount of artificial intelligence from one point of view. You tell it to go in that particular direction, and you give it instructions ahead of time that if it runs into a rock, walk around it. If you run into a hole, walk around it, and so on. Move slowly, be careful. Don't get yourself upside down and into a big hole. They give it all kinds of programming. So it's got a kind of very low-level artificial intelligence. And so for these things to be more intelligent, more small, more effective as time goes on is obvious, more autonomous. I'm reasonably convinced there's going to be thoroughly automatically driven vehicles within our lifetime. Let me drop. Because properly done, the accident rate will be lower. 35 or 40,000 people in the United States die because of automobile accidents right now. A human being driving a car does a pretty good job, but it could be better with greater automation. You had a comment on all of the above. Go ahead, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I was listening to what you were saying, and I have a problem with some of the things that you're explaining. And also a question, one of the questions would be, how would you differ dark matter and dark energy? You were talking about black hole that was prior to the Big Bang. Then we have a question with the backward causation. Well, I don't know what to start from, but let's say we need to establish cause and effect.